In a world where reggae is often reduced to sunshine and ganja smoke, the Mighty Diamonds carved a deeper groove, one that cut through the noise with razor-sharp harmonies and revolutionary fire, while the global audience sang along to Right Time and I Need a Roof. Few truly understood the desperation behind the lyrics. Songs written in a Jamaica torn by political warfare, social collapse, and generational poverty. These weren't just melodies. They were manifestos for survival. Their harmonies masked heartbreak. Their melodies carried warnings. And their message, that even in the ghetto, dignity is non-negotiable. But how did a trio from Trenchtown manage to transform spiritual Rastafarian wisdom and street-level realism into internationally respected art? Why were they targeted, censored, and yet never silenced? And what price did they pay for singing truth to power? This is more than a tribute to a reggae group. It's a journey through colonial scars, prophetic defiance, and the cost of consciousness in a world that would rather forget. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Trenchtown Prophets. Trenchtown. Just the name conjures images. Corrugated zinc fences. Smoke curling up from cook fires. Children playing barefoot in dusty yards, and a soundtrack of soulful bass lines drifting through cracked speakers. But for the Mighty Diamonds, Donald Tabby Shaw, Fitzroy Bunny Simpson, and Lloyd Judge Ferguson, Trenchtown wasn't just the backdrop of their lives. It was the furnace that forged them. In the 1960s and early 70s, Jamaica was still grappling with the legacy of its so-called independence. Officially free from British rule since 1962, the island found itself in a different kind of bondage. Economic inequality, imported ideologies, and political violence had begun to rot the promises of self-governance. Communities like Trenchtown, often romanticized by outsiders, became the front line of a new kind of war. The war for cultural survival. Tabby Shaw, the charismatic lead voice of the trio, had grown up singing gospel in church. His voice, smooth, pure, and deeply. Jamaica, and the world that prophets are only protected in memory, not in life? Why was it easier to dance to their message than to defend them when they were under threat? The silence from political leaders was deafening. The music industry offered only tepid condolences, but the streets knew. The Mighty Diamonds had never been protected by systems. They had been protected by faith, by unity, by a brotherhood that resisted compromise. Once that bond was broken, the wolves circled. Still, Judge Ferguson, the last standing diamond, vowed not to let the harmony fade. In an emotional statement to the press, Judge said, "We never sang for fame. We sang for the people, and we'll keep singing, even if only one voice remained." And he did. Judge began re-releasing remastered versions of their classics, ensuring that new generations wouldn't only hear the diamonds, they'd feel them. He launched the Right Time Foundation, dedicated to supporting youth in underprivileged Jamaican communities through music and education. And at tribute concerts, he stood alone center stage, not as a survivor, but as a steward of memory. But even he knew the truth. The full harmony could never return. The Mighty Diamonds, as the world had known them, were now eternal. Not in flesh, but in frequency. Their legacy, though, lives in more than just nostalgia. You can hear their influence in every roots revivalist artist from Chronix to Protégé. You can see it in the resurgence of conscious reggae across Africa and Latin America. You can feel it in the reverence with which elders speak their names in vinyl shops, in Nyabingi drumming circles, in prison cells where the music gives inmates hope. The Mighty Diamonds prove that harmony isn't weakness, that truth doesn't need to shout to be heard, and that even in the dirtiest corners of Babylon, beauty can be born. They did not live to see the full reward of their sacrifice, but they lived long enough to plant seeds, and those seeds, they're still blooming. But perhaps their greatest legacy is the question they leave behind. What do we do with voices that risk everything to speak truth? Once they're gone, do we stream their songs and call it tribute? Do we hang their portraits and forget the message? Or do we take up the harmony they left behind and sing louder? Because as much as the mighty diamonds were prophets, they were also mirrors. They showed us not just who we are, but who we could be. And when the right time come, they didn't just predict a revolution, they called for one. That revolution isn't in the charts. It isn't in Grammy nominations. It's in every act of defiance against silence, in every youth who sings truth instead of following trend, in every artist who chooses message over money. The Mighty Diamonds didn't just give us music, they gave us a map. Their final harmony echoes still, not in perfect pitch, but in perfect purpose. And maybe that's the greatest lesson of all. Legends don't die, they multiply. Expressive, held a pain that couldn't be taught. Bunny Simpson, quieter and more introspective, brought structure and seriousness to their vision. And Judge Ferguson, the baritone anchor, was the stabilizing force, known among peers as the voice of reason. Together, they were less a band and more a unified body. Three voices breathing from one lung, singing truths others were too afraid to say. Their early influences included the soulful harmonies of The Impressions and The Temptations, which had reached Jamaican airwaves via American radio. But it wasn't just about music, it was about message. The Mighty Diamonds saw in Curtis Mayfield's social commentary a mirror of their own struggles, and in the spiritual rebellion of Rastafari, a roadmap to liberation. They began singing in local talent shows, often improvising their way into hearts with harmonies that defied the chaos outside. The streets around them echoed with gunshots from gang rivalries, many of which were politically motivated. Jamaica in the 1970s was split down the middle. Michael Manley's democratic socialism on one side, Edward Seeger's capitalist conservatism on the other. Trenchtown, unfortunately, bore the brunt of both ideologies clashing. Still, the Diamonds refused to pick a side. They weren't interested in political puppetry. They were rooted in something deeper. Ja is our guide, Tabby once told a local journalist. We not sing for party. We sing for the people. It was in this crucible of tension and faith that the song, Right Time, was born. Released in 1976, the track wasn't just a hit. It was a war cry, with lines like, the rich is getting richer, and the poor is getting poorer. It struck a nerve with those who lived the realities mainstream media refused to show. Over a hypnotic rhythm, laced with haunting horns and slow-burning drums, the Mighty Diamonds delivered one of the most politically charged and spiritually potent songs in reggae history. And the people listened. From Kingston's ghettos to the immigrant neighborhoods of London and Brooklyn, Right Time echoed across the diaspora, but success brought visibility, and visibility brought danger. The Diamonds had stepped into a sacred realm, where music was no longer entertainment, but prophecy. Their debut album, also titled Right Time, became an instant classic. Produced by the legendary Joseph Hu Kim at Channel One Studio, the record was both a sonic revolution and a cultural awakening. The Diamonds brought back something the industry was starting to lose: purpose. Songs like I Need a Roof were deceptively gentle in delivery, but harrowing in meaning. On the surface, it was a plea for shelter, but beneath the melody was a declaration of dignity, of the basic human right to a safe home, something denied to thousands across Kingston slums. I need a roof over my head, Tabby sang with aching grace, and bread on my table. It was the kind of line that cut across political divisions, religious identities, and even borders. It wasn't a Jamaican problem. It was a human one. Their music gave voice to those who had none. Women raising children alone in tenement yards. Rastafari elders persecuted for their beliefs. Young men with no future beyond gun violence. The Mighty Diamonds were not immune to this pain. They were of it. But instead of succumbing to bitterness or escapism, they transformed it into harmony. It wasn't long before the group's sound began to evolve. Layered harmonies over dub-heavy arrangements, meditative lyrics over militant beats. They began working with some of the island's most respected musicians, Sly Dunbar on drums, Robbie Shakespeare on bass, and the Soul Syndicate Band on live arrangements. But their message never wavered. In the midst of their rise, something strange began to happen. They found themselves both celebrated and surveilled. Some radio stations refused to play their more militant tracks. Government-aligned producers tried to redirect their lyrics toward less inflammatory topics. And in the shadows, whispers circulated that their names had been added to unofficial blacklists of subversive artists. But the Mighty Diamonds weren't interested in playing safe. As Judge Ferguson said in a rare 1977 interview, "If the system share tech truth, then the system a lie." Their refusal to dilute their message made them heroes in the eyes of the oppressed and targets in the eyes of those who profited from that oppression. Yet even as the political fires burned around them, the Mighty Diamonds kept their focus on what they called spiritual militancy. Rastafari wasn't a religion to them. It was a lens through which to view justice, dignity, and the arc of human history. In their eyes, Babylon was not just the West. It was any force, internal or external, that tried to disconnect people from their divine humanity. This belief fueled songs like Africa, which envisioned a return not just to a physical homeland, but to a state of mind, of remembering, of reconnecting, of resisting amnesia. For the Mighty Diamonds, singing about Africa wasn't nostalgia, it was rebellion. They weren't alone in this movement. The 1970s were a golden era for roots reggae, with artists like Burning Spear, Culture, and Peter Tosh also fusing militant lyrics with spiritual clarity. But what set the Mighty Diamonds apart was their unmatched vocal unity. Their harmonies weren't just technically flawless. They felt ancestral, like voices that had sung together long before birth. Still, not everyone embraced their message. In a scene increasingly drawn toward commercial dancehall and lighter themes, the Mighty Diamonds were seen by some as relics, too serious, too grounded, too real. And yet, the more the industry shifted, the more the people returned to the old songs. When violence flared during the 1980 general elections, leaving over 800 people dead, songs like Right Time were played in candlelit memorials, rallies for peace, and homes too afraid to open their doors at night. Even political parties that once dismissed their music tried to co-opt its power, but the Diamonds never gave their message to Babylon. Not then, not ever. By the end of the decade, they had achieved something rare, not just longevity, but reverence. They hadn't just survived, they had stayed true. Their journey from a dusty trench town corner to international stages was never about fame. It was about bearing witness, about proving that three voices, harmonized in truth, could still be louder than bullets, greed, and lies. And as the 70s bled into the 80s, the Mighty Diamonds faced a new chapter, one where the international spotlight came with bigger risks, deeper betrayals, and choices that would test everything they believed in. But that's where we go next. Chapter 2, Harmony in Babylon. By the early 1980s, the Mighty Diamonds had become something rare in the reggae world, a trio that had not only survived the brutal churn of Jamaica's political turmoil, but had done so without splintering, selling out, or silencing themselves. While other artists shifted toward the rising tide of slackness and dancehall, the Diamonds doubled down on truth, harmony, and roots. And Babylon was watching. International success had opened new doors, but not all of them led to freedom. Tours through the United Kingdom, West Africa, and the U.S. brought them into contact with a global black diaspora struggling with its own forms of oppression, racism, classism, identity erasure. For fans in Brixton, Brooklyn, and Lagos, The Mighty Diamonds were more than a reggae group. They were messengers, emissaries from a spiritual front line. But while the trio was celebrated abroad, the fire back home still burned. Kingston in the early 80s had not mellowed. The scars of the 1980 elections, which had turned entire neighborhoods into war zones, were still fresh. Political gang warfare, armed by Cold War proxy funding from both the U.S. and Cuba, had split the country into ideological camps that often fought to the death. And in this fractured, burning Babylon, artists like the Mighty Diamonds were expected to pick sides or disappear. The Diamonds refused. Their loyalty was not to a political party. It was to Rastafari, to truth, to the ghetto people. That stance made them enemies in high places. At concerts, they were warned not to sing certain songs. At studios, they were told to tone down the militancy. Even fellow musicians, fearing for their own safety, advised them to shift with the times. But the Diamonds were immovable. In 1981, when Bob Marley died, the world mourned the loss of reggae's most visible prophet. For many, the movement seemed to pause. Commercial interests circled like vultures, eager to strip roots reggae of its revolutionary core. Labels began to favor lighter themes, party music, love songs, sanitized beats. And yet, the Mighty Diamonds continued to sing about repatriation, about economic injustice, about spiritual war. Their 1982 album, Changes, though less celebrated commercially, was a spiritual successor to Right Time, a reaffirmation of their purpose. In tracks like Leaders of Black Countries, they called out corrupt African heads of state who had betrayed the dreams of liberation. In Just Can't Figure Out, they questioned why the oppressed had turned on each other. These were not safe songs. They were dangerous questions set to beautiful melodies. International audiences, especially black communities abroad, hungered for this kind of truth. In London's underground reggae scene, DJs hailed them as the realest voice in roots. In Lagos, their message resonated with students resisting military dictatorship. In Harlem, they were played on pirate radio stations alongside speeches by Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey. The Diamonds had become not just Jamaican legends, but global griots. And yet at home, they were increasingly under threat. In 1984, during a show in Spanish Town, anonymous men fired shots at the venue before the group had taken the stage. No one was injured, but the message was clear. The Diamonds were stepping on powerful toes. Later that year, Bunny Simpson's house was raided. No drugs, no weapons, just intimidation. Tabby Shaw, in an interview with a London journalist, said it plainly. The system want music, but not message. Babylon Shah tech harmony and honesty same time. Despite this, the trio pressed forward. What held them together wasn't just ideology, it was brotherhood. While many reggae groups fractured over ego, money, or industry manipulation, the Mighty Diamonds remained united. Each man had his role. Tabby was the face and lead voice. Bunny was the arranger and organizer. Judge was the anchor. They functioned more like a council than a band. Decisions were made collectively. Royalties were split evenly. There was no lead star, only the mission. Their live shows became something sacred. While newer acts dominated the charts with boastful lyrics and computerized rhythms, the Diamonds filled halls with people who wanted truth. They didn't jump on trends. They created sanctuaries. One night in Paris, they opened with I Need a Roof to a crowd of immigrants, refugees, and exiles. By the second verse, grown men were crying in the audience. They followed with Have Mercy, and the room transformed into a congregation. The Diamonds didn't perform songs. They conducted emotional baptisms. But success abroad came with complications. Major labels approached them with lucrative contracts on one condition: change the content, soften the message, focus on romance, not revolution. The Diamonds refused. They were offered sponsorships, radio placements, and marketing deals. Every time, the price was their integrity. Every time, they walked away. In one infamous case, a European record executive reportedly offered to double their advance if they replaced Africa with a more relatable song about partying in Kingston. Tabby's response was swift and final. Africa Nah replaced by Fally. We Nah sell vision for Visa. Their resistance cost them mainstream fame, but earned them something far more valuable, reverence. Back home, however, the landscape was changing again. The rise of dancehall in the late 80s brought a seismic shift in Jamaican music. Artists like Shabba Ranks and Ninja Man took center stage with lyrics that celebrated masculinity, sex, and street dominance. The rhythm changed, faster, bolder, more aggressive. Roots artists were pushed to the margins. Radio DJs began calling them dinosaurs. Producers stopped investing in their sound. Concert promoters passed them over for flashier, younger acts. But the Diamonds didn't panic. Instead, they adapted without compromising. They recorded acoustic versions of their classics. They collaborated with younger artists who respected the foundation. They performed at cultural festivals, universities, and spiritual gatherings. In 1988, they released Get Ready, which fused roots harmonies with modern arrangements. It wasn't a commercial smash, but it resonated deeply with their core audience. Songs like Respect Do became anthems for a new generation of conscious youth trying to find footing in a fractured world. And yet, the challenges never stopped. That same year, a fire destroyed part of their rehearsal space. Rumors circulated that it wasn't an accident. Some whispered that their continued outspokenness had made them targets again. But the Diamonds didn't flinch. They rebuilt. Trouble Cha stop mission, Bunny told a reporter. Not when Ja hand pon we shoulder. Their music became more than art. It became archive, a record of resistance, a spiritual survival guide for anyone trapped in Babylon, whether by poverty, racism, or disillusionment. The Mighty Diamonds were no longer just a group. They were a movement. And movements don't fade, they evolve. As the 90s approached, a new threat emerged. Not political violence, but erasure. History was being rewritten in real time. Roots reggae was being reduced to nostalgia. Documentaries and articles barely mentioned the Mighty Diamonds, even as their influence shaped the sound and message of countless artists. But the people remembered. Ask the Maroons in the hills of Jamaica, who played at their celebrations. Ask the Zimbabwean freedom fighters what music they carried into battle. Ask the elders in Kingston which voices told the truth when politicians only told lies. The answer was always the same. The Mighty Diamonds. As their second decade together came to a close, it became clear. The Diamonds had achieved something extraordinary. In an industry that chews up artists and spits out caricatures, they had remained whole, unbroken, untamed. But time was catching up. Health issues began to affect Bunny. Tabby carried more of the live vocals. Judge became increasingly reclusive. Their schedule slowed, but their fire didn't. They began mentoring younger artists, teaching harmony, spiritual discipline, and lyrical responsibility. They weren't interested in trends. They were planting seeds. As the 20th century closed, so did a chapter in their story. But one question remained. What happens to prophets when the people stop listening? The answer would come in the most tragic and unexpected way. Chapter 3. Blood, silence, and legacy. Legends aren't supposed to bleed. They're not supposed to die in dim-lit streets or vanish into obscurity. They're supposed to fade gently into applause, into lifetime achievement awards, into televised tributes, and rock-solid legacies. But the Mighty Diamonds never followed the script, and their final act was no exception. In March 2022, just months before what was meant to be a long-awaited international reunion tour, the reggae world was shaken by brutal news. Donald Tabby Shaw, the voice of Right Time, the soul of I Need a Roof, had been shot and killed in Kingston. A drive-by, broad daylight, no warning, no mercy. The sound of the gunfire echoed louder than any song that day, not just because it silenced a legend, but because of what it symbolized. That even the most revered voices in Jamaican culture were still vulnerable. That no matter how many truths you sang, Babylon could still take you out in a single breath. The nation mourned, the diaspora wept, but for those who had followed the diamond's journey from the zinc fences of Trenchtown to global stages, the shock wasn't just personal, it was prophetic. Tabby had always warned us, when you sing truth, you have to walk with shield. He just never said the shield would fail. What made the murder even more gut-wrenching was the silence that followed. No immediate arrests, no international outcry, no global headlines, like you might expect for the murder of a cultural icon. It was as if the world had already moved on and left the roots behind. But the diamond's core audience, those in the trenches, in the vinyl shops, in the Rastafarian communities, in the backyards where roots reggae still ruled, knew better. This wasn't just another tragedy. This was a spiritual gut punch. Because the truth was undeniable. The mighty diamonds had given their lives, literally and figuratively, to the people. And now Babylon had taken one of them back, Bunny Simpson. Already battling illness at the time of Tabby's death, passed away just days later. Some said it was grief. Others whispered that he simply gave up. Two warriors bound so tightly in spirit that one couldn't survive the other's fall. With Judge Ferguson, now the sole surviving diamond, a painful question loomed. Was this the end of the harmony? In many ways, yes, but not in the way Babylon might have hoped, because even in death, the mighty diamond's message refused to die. In the weeks following Tabby's murder, streams of Right Time and I Need a Roof surged worldwide. Young activists quoted their lyrics on social media. Reggae revivalists sampled their harmonies in protest songs. And from Kingston to Cape Town, murals of Tabby's face appeared like spiritual graffiti, modern hieroglyphs in the language of resistance. Even as their physical voices were silenced, their message grew louder. But the violence that killed Tabby raised larger, haunting questions. How could a man who sang about dignity, truth, and spiritual unity fall victim to such senseless brutality in his own homeland? What does it say about